Hey, it's Bubba Wallace from 2311 Racing. You know what feels like forever? Sitting on a plane waiting for takeoff. Good thing I've got Chumba Casino. With daily boosts and social casino games on tap, this is the kind of fun that makes time fly. Why not turbocharge your downtime? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at rss.com.
Welcome to Breaking Math, the podcast where we not only prove theorems, but also look at regressions, policies, and procedures in the world of data visualization. I'm your host, Autumn Phaneuf. Today, we're joined by Dr. Jonathan Schwabisch. He's an economist, writer, teacher, and data communications expert. He is considered a leading voice of clarity and accessibility in how analysts, researchers, and scholars communicate their findings. Across four books, he has provided a comprehensive guide to creating, communicating, and distributing data-rich content. Better Presentations coaches people through preparing, designing, and delivering data communication products. Elevate the Debate helps people develop a strategic plan to communicating their own work across multiple platforms and channels. Better Data Visualizations details essential strategies to create more effective data visualizations. His most recent book, Data Visualizations in Excel, helps readers create better graphs and charts in the Excel software tool. So, stay tuned to listen to what good data looks like on this week's episode of Breaking Math. Hi, John. How are you doing today?
I'm well, Autumn. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on the show. Now, tell the guests a little bit about what you do behind the scenes at PolicyViz and also your career as a data analyst and economist.
Sure. Yeah, I mean it's a long path, so we'll keep it short, because we got a lot to talk about, a lot of fun stuff.
Of course.
Yes. Yeah, I'm trained as an economist. I did my schoolwork here in the States at the University of Wisconsin and Syracuse University. I spent about a decade working for the Congressional Budget Office, which is basically the budget arm of the U.S. Congress. And while there, kind of towards the end of my tenure, I started to get, I think, a little frustrated with how I think the media wasn't really using a lot of the analyses and reports and things that we were producing. And even like members of Congress weren't using it. It was just kind of frustrating. And so I started to think about, you know, what is it like, how can we get our stuff to stand out? And this was like in the pre-social media days, right? So you had sort of more, you know, kind of legacy media. You had sort of dedicated channels. And it turns out there's this whole world of data visualization, of people actually thinking carefully about how to communicate your data, which is something that, like, I don't know, I was never exposed to in any schooling, like certainly graduate school. There's never any talk of like, how do you present? How do you write? How do you speak? How do you make good graphs? Like, it's just not part of it. And so I dove headfirst into this world, met some great people, and then just started making things and pretty quickly realized that, like, if you just spend a little bit of time thinking about how your reader or user or audience member, whoever it is, how they are going to use it and what they need, you're just going to make better stuff. And so I'm not a designer. I'm not a developer, web developer. I'm an economist. So like, but all you have to really do to start is just to think about what people need. Like, maybe they don't even need a graph. Maybe they just need a table, or maybe you've been showing them tables, but they need a graph. Like, that's the sort of thing. It's just like strategic thinking. And so I was there. I worked at CEO for a long time, and then I moved to the Urban Institute, which is a nonprofit. I'm based in Virginia, but the institute's in D.C., so right across the river. And I still do economic research, mostly on nutrition policy and disability policy. And then I started my own side little hustle, as the world is these days, Policy Viz, where I do similar sorts of work, consulting with folks, building tools, writing, all the sorts of good stuff, having my own podcast. I mean, all the stuff, Autumn, you know how it is. Like, yep. always
it's par for the course.
Yeah, that's right. That's
one thing helps the other, helps
that's
the
right.
next thing.
That's
and...
right. That's work in the 2020s is just... a constant hamster wheel. So
yes,
I come to this world again not through a design eye, not through a kind of computer science eye, but through the, I guess I would say, the data, the research eye, and recognizing, I think, that a lot of folks who also come on that same journey, that same path, don't think about the other pieces of the puzzle.
Right.
I think more so now than in the past, clearly. I mean, the tools that we can talk about later, the tools are better, the browsers are faster, the media organizations have accelerated how important data and data visualization is in their workflow. So there's a lot of reasons why I think people are more attuned to it than they were when I first started. But it is, I think, at its core, if you're thinking about how do I get my research, my data, my analysis, my math out there so people can understand it, like the visual, we know visuals work, and you don't really have to, again, get an MFA in design. Just think about what is your, that key person, that key group, that key stakeholder, what do they want to see? What's going to help them do their job better? What's going to help them find insights? And once you sort of identify that, the rest is really just gravy on top.
Definitely. Now, I've done data, whether it's been in my courses or, just in working, right? So everybody's a scientist. Everyone talks about good data. What exactly is good data?
Ooh, that's a really good question. And I guess it's going to be, in some ways, it's going to be specific to the sector or the field or the science, right? But
right.
I would say, in general, what is good data? I mean, I think good data has, now we're not going to get into all the statistics here because we'll be here all day. It'll be super fun. We'll be all right.
We like numbers here.
We do like numbers, right? So what constitutes good data? I mean, I think first is it's the sample selection is neutral and objective. That doesn't mean it doesn't have outliers or it, necessarily follows a normal distribution. But the sample itself is not biased. We understand who did the survey and how the survey was conducted and how the data were collected. I really do think that's an underappreciated part of working with data, is understanding how things are actually collected. I mean, we know, right? Now, I'm telling you all the things I'm not. So I'm not a survey methodologist, but we know that people answer surveys differently if it's pen and paper versus on the phone versus on their cell phone as a, typing in versus on their desktop. We know those are different. We know people answer questions differently depending on the order of the survey, depending on what the options are and individual questions. So really understanding the data that you're working with and how they're collected, I think that's really the key. And, it's a kind of a tricky question. I mean, we're like end of August here, we're recording. And just a few days ago, the Bureau of Labor Statistics came out with like massive revisions to the unemployment rate data, like massive
sure.
revisions, right? And so if you said to me, yeah, do you think the Bureau of Labor Statistics has good data? I would say, yeah, it's like, it's the best, right? Like they are the best. And then they have these massive revisions. And I don't think that means that their data are bad. It just means like, if I use those data 3 weeks ago, I'd have to redo my analysis now because the data have not changed. So I think I guess part of this is depending again on what you're doing and what your sector is and what your goal is. Data is kind of a living, breathing thing, and you have these changes and updates and edits, and it's hard to, you know, keep track of. And I mean, it's hard work. I mean, I guess I'll end it there for folks who are, you know, maybe who are just getting started in the data world, working with data. And it doesn't matter if you're, you know, a school teacher looking at the survey results of parents, or, you know, you're downloading data from the Census Bureau. It's all hard because all these questions apply. And I think if you're getting into this journey of being a data person, I think really understanding what the data are, where they come from, how they were collected is really the first step.
Sure. Now, what are some of the most common mistakes that people make when creating data visualizations?
So I struggle here because it's a really interesting question, but I think my, like a lot of people's knee-jerk reaction to that question is, here are some specific rules, right? You need to follow this rule and not follow this rule. But data visualization is interesting because it's a little bit of a combination of art and science. And so there is the science of it, particularly around how you use data. There's also art. So how do you put rules around art? So I think that's like, you know, I would just caveat my answer with that. So I would say, I will give you one rule. This is the only rule that I believe in, and that, okay, well, let me pause one second. Like, should pie charts sum to 100%?
Yes.
They should sum to 100%. Is that a rule or is that common sense? I don't know. Like, I kind of just feel like that's common sense. But if you want to call a rule, like, okay. The only rule that I really believe in is that bar charts, horizontal or vertical, should start at zero. The axis should always start at zero. And that's because the way we read or understand a bar chart is by the length of the bar. And so the thought experiment that I like to do is create a bar chart of just two bars, and imagine the increments on your y-axis are each, say, an inch, and calculate the height of the bars when the bar start at zero. And now start the graph at something other than zero, have the same inch height on each increment, and recalculate. And what you'll find is that you have this overemphasis in the heights of the two bars. So just a little bit of math can get you a long way here. So what, you know, what else makes a good graph? I mean, for me, I look for a few things in visualizations, are sort of like the things that perk my ears off of life, when they, like, warning signs. I guess I call these warning signs for people like trying to distort a lie. Things like percent change when maybe the levels are meaningful, right? If you say, oh, this thing grew by 300%, it's like, okay, yeah, it went from 1 to 4. Like, is that meaningful for one person to four people? Like, yeah, it's, but maybe that's not meaningful, right?
It depends on your population size and the data, right?
Right, exactly. So it totally depends. But like, you know, that's the sort of thing that, like, especially if it's not a topic I'm particularly, well, especially if I am familiar with it, but also if I'm not familiar with it, like, okay, are they showing me the percent change because it's, you know, we're starting with a small baseline and maybe that big growth doesn't really matter. So that's one. Log scales. Not that I think log scales are bad. It's just, you know, a lot of people have a hard time interpreting log scales. And so you don't see them a lot, but that's one. Another one that I love, and I have so many examples of these, is when people overlay regression lines on scatter plots. Cause it's so easy. Like, Autumn, I feel like you and I could talk about this world, but like,
absolutely.
Right. Like, it's so easy to be like, oh, here's some polynomial, and now you've got this weird line that makes zero sense. Or the opposite, where it's just a linear one, right?
Or they just figure out what's the line of best fit, and it's just not going according to the data.
Yeah, I mean, there's all, like, that's the thing about regression models, right, is you can play around with the model. And then, I mean, you know, a dishonest person can get a model to fit and they can say, oh, I ran a regression. And lots of people are like, ooh, that's pretty fancy. But you're just.
But what does it mean?
Right. What does it mean? Yeah. Right. You're just kind of lying.
Yep.
And then I guess the other one, this is sort of just a general one.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Game night's fun until someone spends 5 minutes lining up one shot. Chalk, breathe, rechalk. Still aiming. While they figure it out, I fire up Chumba Casino. I can spin anywhere, anytime, and there's always a new social casino game every week. Spins happen way faster than that shot. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at RSS.com.
But comes back to the board chart point. Is anytime someone has made an arbitrary decision in their graph, this is sort of just like a general one. An arbitrary decision to me is the one to look out for. So the bar chart not starting at zero is a great example. If you start your bar chart at something other than zero, you've made some arbitrary decision of where to start. You started at 34% or $699. Like, that's arbitrary. And so why did the person do that, right? A really good example is there's this website, and I don't actually know if he keeps it updated anymore, but it's this this guy's named Tyler Vegan. It's VIGEN.com. And it's called Spurious Correlations. You're nodding, so you know this site. This site is great.
Yes.
And all he does is create these dual axis line charts. So one line to one axis, another line to another axis, and just plays with the ranges and scales of the axes. So that these lines look like they're lying on top of each other when, you know, they're seemingly totally separate trends. But
yeah,
again, these arbitrary decisions about what range you're going to use, what min and max, what increments you're going to use, you can make things kind of look the way you want them to look. And so those are the things that I look out for when I'm looking at people's visualizations.
Especially when you're doing policies and procedures and you need to make those decisions right then and there.
Right, exactly.
So do you have another example that can talk about data visualization and how that has a significant impact on policy decisions?
Yeah, I have a couple. I mean, it is a little tricky, right? Because you want to be able to say, this kind of like to our regression point, right? Like, you want to be able to say, here's a graph that affected this thing that affected this outcome. And life just isn't that simple. So impact in that way is hard to measure. But I will tell you this story. I made an infographic, which is like, you know, infographics back in the day were like these big tower things or combinations of graphs and text and pictures and all this stuff. And I made several of those and discovered, I think, pretty quickly that people just weren't even reading these tower infographics. There was just so much to scroll through. It just wasn't natural. So I made an infographic that accompanied a 150, 200 page report for CBO. It was just 8.5 by 11. The whole point was to print it. CBO members of Congress like paper. So back to the very beginning of this conversation, right? Let's make things that meet people where they are, right? If you're in a print town, print stuff out. If you're in an area where there's not broadband, your big old dashboard ain't going to work. Sorry. So meet people where they are.
Sure.
So I made this one page infographic and we delivered it to members on the Hill. And a few months later, the director was testifying and the ranking member of the committee held up that printed infographic with his scribbles all over it. Yeah, exactly. It was pumping my fist. I was like, this is amazing. Because
I get this.
Again, yeah. You're okay, so does that mean, you know, there's this particular outcome? No, but you have provided the information to the person so that they can use it. I am by no means saying members of Congress are dumb or can't read, although I could maybe make that. Just take that argument. But they're busy people. Yeah, they're busy people, right? They've got a lot of stuff on their plate. And so they're not going to read a 150-page report because they have to read 12 of them a day.
Right. So, right? You're thrown so much information and policy. And I would say even sometimes in academia, when you're teaching, you're making quick executive decisions, even as a CEO or COO of a company, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes you have 501 things. What is the simplest form of data or policy or procedure that's going to come across and just be like, here, look at this picture.
Right.
And that's what clicks. That's what sticks in your head. Sometimes it's not all of that fine text that you have to read.
Yeah, if you're the CEO of a company, you don't need a 150-page report to dive into the data. That's what your employees are for, right? At the end of the day, they're bringing you the recommendation or the answer or whatever it is, right? So, like, here are the five numbers you need to know. And again, it's not a knock on anyone's intelligence. It's just the way the world is that we have lots of competing demands. And depending on your role, again, you might be the budget analyst for organization XYZ, and your job is to read the 150-page. But maybe the president of your organization, they're also not going to read it. And, you know, that's okay. We've all got lots of things. So, this one pager, again, it wasn't like, oh, he has this one pager, and therefore we got this outcome. But it was clear we made this one pager. And he read it and he used it and he took notes on it. And that's a fist pumping win right there, right? That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to get information, analysis data into the hands of people who can use it. And we do that the best we can and in a clear, objective, useful way. And then we hope that they go on and make the right decision.
Definitely. Now, with that, where do you see the role of data visualization evolving in the next 5 years, maybe even the next decade?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first answer has to be what's going to happen with AI, right? I mean, I think that's the first clear question, clear answer. A lot of data visualization work is done through code, done in programming languages, R, JavaScript, Python, Svelte, several others. AI makes the coding task easier.
It does.
Hey, write me a code that does this thing. And, you know, I use it for a lot of my stuff when I do like more advanced stuff in Excel. I use it to write VBA code and like, it's generally right. So I think that's the first place, certainly on the coding place, I think we're already kind of almost there. Then I think the next question is, how does AI get embedded or integrated into the data visualization tools? This is already happening. You know, Microsoft has their Copilot tool. Tableau has something similar. But how does it get integrated into the tools where you can say, you know, hey, here's my data. Show me six options or six variations. Or, okay, great. Show me that bar chart you just created using a style that, you know, Autumn would use, right? Like, I mean, that's the capability it's going to have, right? Or, you know, okay, make that bar chart in the form that, you know, The Economist or The Washington Post would make it in. I think that's sort of almost the low-hanging fruit in some ways. I think a lot of tools kind of already do that. I think the next stage is, how is AI going to help us see more and better insights into the data, right?
Especially if it's complex and with a lot of different trends, it could show you a lot of patterns that, you know, you're not picking up yourself.
Right. And I also worry, I mean, we know there's bias built into these tools already. And I worry a little bit about, you know, if the tool doesn't know the quality of the data, so it's just going to use the data as if this is right. So there's that caveat. But I think it's also, if you're asking the tool to be informed by other sources or other resources, what is it pulling from? Like, what is it looking at? What other literatures is it reviewing? You know, if you're going to say, you know, I want to analyze these 12 variables. What are some recommended models, right? Mm-hmm. What is it pulling from? Like, what is the research basis that it's reviewing, right? Is that biased towards, you know, We can make it simple, like U.S. research versus U.K. versus Asian, research in Asian countries. Is it just looking at certain fields? Like there's a lot of questions I think there. And I'm curious to see, I think the other thing that I'm curious to see how things will evolve in terms of the future of data is how our technology, not just our AI technology, but like our physical, like our phones in particular, like how are our phones going to change in the next several years that will either facilitate or not facilitate our use of data in different ways? And by that, I mean, we saw kind of in like the early 2000s into like the early 2010s, like this real huge increase in people making interactive data visualizations on every website, every bar chart, every line chart was interactive. You could click, you could swipe, you could do all this stuff. And then folks started to realize like, okay, everybody's on their phone. No one's like filtering and searching. So we don't need, no one's clicking. So we don't need like all this fanciness. Let's go back to static graphs. And then the phones got
Definitely.
really big, and then they got sort of smaller again. And so where are we going to end up in the next few years, right? Like in terms of size, speed, different platforms. I mean, and then I guess the last thing I would say is, where is augmented reality, virtual reality going to fall into this? I've seen some really interesting use cases, and there's a lot of research going on around the world, and especially in AR, to kind of give like this. I don't know what these folks would call it, but to me, it's like it's almost like virtual tactile visualization. So I can actually like take the bar, like it's a Minority Report, right? Where I can take the bar chart, I can zoom in, right, in the sort of in the air, right? So is that
It's
where we're
more
going to end up?
interactive.
Yeah, and it's not mouse based, and there's also some advantages there from an accessibility perspective, right? If you're unable to use a mouse for lots of different reasons, right? I could break my arm tomorrow and not be able to use my mouse, but I might be able to use my hand to zoom
Hand.
in and zoom out and pan and scroll. Yeah, I mean, I think there's some interesting use cases there, and so there's a lot of interesting things that are going to happen, and we'll just. I'm not scared of the Terminators yet. So I think, it'd be interesting to see.
I think something that you haven't really thought about also is with large amounts of data is going to be the security that you are going to have to think about. Are these going to be, we just saw Microsoft have a whole collapse with their system for all the transportation for airplanes globally. So what does that mean for even Google? Right. So our largest platforms are Microsoft, Google, and
Well,
there's one
Apple.
other. And most government things are on Microsoft. Other systems are, and even if you're talking about crypto, it's AWS. So that really brings in some questions of, where's the security going to lie? Is it going to be in these systems, or are they going to be smaller towers that are like stored for companies when you're doing all this data, right?
And I didn't back up from that, right? Because if you're worried that your data is at risk, are you as willing to answer a survey? Right? I mean, so it, and, I mean, the Census Bureau ha there are federal laws on the books that say what the Census Bureau can and can't do to protect people's privacy, because they know if they say, oh yeah, we're just going to share all of your information, you're less likely to answer that survey. So if our data is at risk through not the Census Bureau's fault, but through how data are stored and shared and that sort of thing, are people just going to be more reluctant to answer surveys? And that's going to hurt our data quality. So there's a lot of, and I have a
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
You're listening to a podcast right now. driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode, and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at RSS.com.
Because on the, I keep mentioning the Census Bureau, I know, because that's just, you know, where my world is. But, you know, if you're going to do the school teacher one, if you're in a school teacher and you're collecting data on, oh my God, if you're collecting data on kids and your data are stored in the cloud and that data is lost or hacked or revealed, like, you know, there's a lot of considerations here about data privacy that
medical systems.
It's hard work. I mean, this is hard stuff to do and to do it well.
Of course. Now, with that, what are some of your favorite tools or software for creating data visualizations?
Ooh, okay. So that's a great question. I'll tell you the first one I use, and a lot of people are going to cringe, but I use Excel for a lot of my work.
I was going to say, I knew that that was the first thing that was going to come out of your mouth. I'm like, I almost wanted to have a flashcard.
Well, I mean, you know, and a lot of people are like, oh, Excel's the worst. Excel makes bad data viz. Like, first off, Excel doesn't make anything. Like, we make this stuff.
Yeah. Right?
Like, we still control.
Excel has a couple auto functions, which are not fantastic all the time.
I mean, look, it's good for what it's good at. If you need to make a bar chart for your report, Excel's great at that. I would never use it to, like, make some sort of interactive data visualization for a website, but that's not what it's for. So I think there's, when people talk about tools, they get, I think, a little bit too much in the, like, you know, what's, like, objectively the best. And I think it's, again, just kind of a use case and an audience. But I'll say I have a few that I do use. So I use Excel a lot of the time. I use the R programming language for, particularly for maps. I will say I'm not a great R coder, but that, again, is what's great about knowing lots of people who do lots of great work. You can always lean on your friends, so that's great. So the library in R is ggplot, so I use ggplot for maps and then some other graph types that are relatively easy to create in R. I do use Tableau for some dashboarding work, and then I'm sure people will be like, why not Power BI? Power BI, for those who know, is like the Microsoft version. I think it's fine, but it's not on the Mac, and I'm primarily on my Mac. So, sorry, like Apple and Microsoft, like, get over it. So we can get the Power BI on the Mac, and like more people can use it. And then there's at least two other tools that I use fairly regularly. They're both based in the browser. So, bottom to your point about data security, like, these are tools you would not use with, like, secure data.
Yeah.
Because it's saved into the cloud. But there are two tools, Data Wrapper with a W, and then Flourish, the Flourish data visualization tool. Both are really nice tools. Both are based in the browser. Both have pretty broad libraries of graphic types. And what's really nice about them is that you can create a graph, you can grab an embed code, drop it on their site pretty quickly. That way it's responsive to different sizes. You know, it has they both have interactivity with them, but, like, okay, if it's gonna resolve the responsiveness issue that, like, a JPEG or a PNG is not, then I'm kind of willing to have a little bit more clickability on it, even though I, you know, may not need it. So yeah, I think that's, like, five tools that I use. I'm not like a web designer. The tools that our data visualization team use at Urban for a lot of our online immersive storytelling, storytelling things, is JavaScript, which is particularly D3. Yep. And then also Svelte is the other one that they're using, with a lot of things like Node throw in there, Node.js throw in there, and a bunch of other things that I do not code in. So but yeah, there's a lot of data viz tools out there, but those are the ones that I pretty much rely on.
those are the ones that you get a little more interactive on the website. So
yeah. So if you go, like, if anyone goes to, like, the New York Times or Washington Post, or really any, like, major news organization, and there's some sort of interactive visualization, or, like, you scroll through and something animates and move around, it is almost certainly built in D3.
Yep.
Which, again, is JavaScript. Almost certainly. Which, again, like, you know, if you can code in that language, more power to you. And again, like, so I think here's, like, the flip side, right, of the Excel makes bad data viz. Excel's good what it's good for. You wouldn't use D3 to do the analysis, right? Because that's not what it's good for, right? You would do your analysis and then that's a data visualization tool. Same thing. Here's another good example. Flourish and DataWrapper, both tools I really like, they are not spreadsheet tools like Excel. So you can't, like, load your data into either of those tools and say, oh, okay, I want to multiply this column by 4. You have to go back to your data tool, which could be Excel or R or whatever tool you use, and then bring the data back in, right? Those are data visualization tools. And Excel, and it's the reason, one of the reasons why I've always used it, is you could do your analysis and your visualization right there in the same same environment. I know lots of people who are like, well, that's what R is for, and you should do it in R, and programming is more scalable and more reproducible. And I totally agree with that. The only caveat I guess I would add is a lot of the folks that I work with tend to be, like, small nonprofit organizations or advocacy organizations. And, like, they have a data person. And the data person is the data person because they, like, showed some affinity of working with, like, Excel or Google Sheets, right? And so
that's what, you know, happens with a lot of cases.
Yeah, exactly. And so that person's not going to, like, go learn R. They have to do their day job. And, you know, they're not going to be able to hire someone to do that. So everybody has Excel. You know, pretty much everybody knows how to make the basics. And so my goal in helping folks with Excel is just to show them how to push the boundaries a little bit, because the rules in the matrix, in Excel are like the matrix. Some can be bent and some can be broken. And so that's how I sort of approach the tools world. Yeah.
Now, sure. I totally get that. Out of curiosity, how do you think policymakers can be better trained to interpret data and use data visualizations?
I mean, I guess, are policymakers any different than anybody else?
Okay. How can anybody?
Anybody? Yeah. I mean, when I tell folks, because a lot of the times when I teach data viz, one of the things that I lean on is showing people lots of different graph types, because we all know line bars, pie charts, bar charts, right? Because we learn those in, I don't know, whatever, third, fourth, fifth grade. It's not like human beings have the bar chart DNA strand, right? Like, we have to learn these. So, I think about, you know, my graduate work, my undergraduate work. Again, no one taught me how to make good graphs or how to make good presentations or how to write well. I think part of what we need to do in the education, especially in sort of like the advanced degrees or there, is to teach people how to be good communicators, right? And it's not just data viz. Like, again, how to be a good writer, like how to be a good storyteller, how to be good, yeah, like all these, and it matters for every job you're going to go into. Like, here's the deal. I have a friend still who's still CBO, and she manages multiple people, and she's like, it shocks me how these, you know, early career folks come into meetings with me and they're unable to, like, have, like, a meeting. And I think, like, being able to communicate in that way, and that's not a presentation in front of an audience of 5,000 people or 100 people. It's a one-on-one presentation. And that's
absolutely
a skill. Yeah. I mean, my oldest kid is a senior in high school. And, you know, one of the things, and, you know, she has lots of friends who have already gone to college. And one of the things that we've been talking to her and lots of others, kids as they go into school, is like, and we hear this from a lot of the admissions officers at schools, like, don't be afraid to go talk to your professors. Like, you should go to office hours. Like, even if you don't have a burning question or a problem, because talking to professionals, talking to your professor, talking to senior people is a skill. And I'm sure there's lots of educators who listen to this, like talking, you know, students talking. It's a skill you have to learn.
It is. I find that to be crucial for networking, especially some of the classes that I taught were 150 freshmen in a course. Biomedical engineering, 150 freshmen.
Yeah.
And fresh out of high school, never interacting with somebody. You get these professors that come in older, I'll say older, 50s, 60s, very professional, and seem kind of harsh and unapproachable until you get the in their office hours. They're sitting cross-legged on the desk saying, hey, what's up? And you don't get that interaction until, 8 weeks in the semester?
Right. Or even if they are more formal, like, you're going to graduate and go into the workforce, and you're going to have a boss who walks to the, some boss is going to walk to the office with no shoes and socks, and another boss is going to wear three-piece suits every day.
See, I've had professors with no shoes on.
I'm not a fan of. I'll just say that right there. I don't want to see your feet. I'm just putting that out there right now. But I think, you know, you asked about policymakers, but I think it's really anybody. And I think especially if you're, you know, young, early career, particularly college students, or even high school students, like, go talk to your teachers. Like, that and that skill, you never perfect that skill, right? You just become a better communicator. You're able to have conversation, be able to guide conversation, learn how to, you know, have facial, look in people's eyes. I mean, I think the technology we have, which is great, you know, we have these supercomputers in our pockets, but, you know, we've sort of lost, I think, a little bit of that face-to-face communication skills. And those are still necessary. And
so essential.
They are. They are essential. And so, you know, yes, I would love for us to, I would love, for example, for calculus to be way less emphasized in high school, and for statistics and probability to be way more emphasized, because, you know, calculus is for the engineers and for the economists, but for most kids are not going to need calculus, but everybody needs to understand how probability works. Everybody, you know, we're in the midst of a presidential election here, right? Everybody needs to understand that when you see 42% and 41%, that those are statistically the same thing. Right. And, you know, calculus doesn't really help you do that. So I would love, you know, I would love to add data viz into that, because I think that makes for a more educated, more data literate society. But I think to your point, Autumn, it's just about being a better communicator, and that takes practice.
And
I don't think you can start early enough about learning how to communicate with people.
Now, what ethical considerations do you take into account when creating visualizations for policy purposes, for procedural practices, or just to an audience?
Yeah. I mean, this is an area that I've been thinking a lot about in the last few years, particularly starting with the racial justice protests in spring of 2020. And there are a variety of ways that I think about this. And I think there's sort of like the simple to the more complex, and the simple, not that it's easy to do, but...
Hey, it's Cole Swindell. After I give everything I've got to land a perfect vocal, I usually take 5 before jumping into the next track. And I've learned exactly how to recharge in that time. Some folks grab coffee. I hit a quick good luck spin. Next thing you know, the break is just as fun as laying down the track. A better break makes for a better take. Need a break? Less Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus TNC supply. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at rss.com.
Sort of like, maybe the more straightforward is the best, better term. It's like, what words do you use to describe people and communities, right? Like, do you describe people by their skin color, or do you say, you know, Hispanic employees or Asian students, right? As opposed to just describing people like as their color. And I think, you know, like an interesting one that we've seen this change over time is like moving towards people first language. So we use like people with disabilities rather than disabled person, right?
Yes.
But there's nuance and subtlety and evolution in language that makes like coming up with like a rule really hard, because there are lots of groups and people who prefer the identity first language, like disabled person, right? Autistic person. I have an example in my notes somewhere of there's an organization that works on behalf of autistic people, and they surveyed their members, and like 80 something percent of their members said that they prefer identity first language rather than person first language. So these are like really hard questions. But the overarching, I think, thread through this body of work that I've been doing at the Urban Institute for the last 3 years or so, which we call our Do No Harm project. So we have about 6-7 reports on this. The sort of thread that pulls through everything is to just have empathy for people, which I think is just like a good rule of thumb, just living. But for data and data viz, is would you, like, here's the thing that I just tell everybody, like, would you feel offended if you were represented in that way in the chart, the graph, the diagram, right? If you were described in that way, in those words, if the color in the graph was assigned to you as a person, how would you feel? If you were represented in that icon of that person, how would that make you feel, right? And if, I think that's a very, I was going to say simple, but it's not really that simple, because we all have our own experiences. So it'd be hard for me as a, you know, as a white man to sort of, you know how, you know, a black woman would feel in seeing a graph in this way. But you, I think, you know, that's what empathy is. And you try to just put yourself in someone else's shoes and think, you know, the thing that you can do is say, okay, is this icon, this graph, this word, let's make it my identity. Is that how I want to be described or shown? And that's sort of like the beginning. And then you kind of move into more depth from there. So how are you going to order the bars in your bar chart or the entries in your table? Are they going to put white and male in the top row or the first bar, which is how Census Bureau products are? They put white is always option one in the race question on race. So we don't have to follow that ordering. That's just based on structures and institutions we've had in this country for, you know, 200 years. So can we maybe think about, well, maybe I should order it based on the magnitude, you know, sort by the bar height or sort alphabetically, or, you know, another one that's not, you know, I mean, every survey that the Census Bureau does on gender, they're all binary, by the way. It's always male and female, and it's always coded male is number one and female is number two, which is not alphabetical. I mean, I guess it's binary, so I guess it's out, but it's not alphabetical in the way we think about it. Yep. It's not alphabetical, and it's not ordered by population size. So it's just saying, well, men go in the first position. And, you know, I think that's how we can start to think about being more equitable and inclusive in the work. And I'll just say here, like, I do get people who push back on some of these ideas that, you know, it's just, oh, it's just woke and it's just, you know, liberal, blah, 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 blah. And I'm happy to take an ethical, moral stand on these issues. But I'm also happy to take kind of like a capitalist stand, right? If I'm selling a product, I want more people to buy that product. And if people feel respected and they feel valued and they feel like you are being empathetic to their lives, their experience, they're more like, I mean, I don't think you need science to know this, right? They're more likely to buy your stuff if they feel like you value them. And so, you know, I'm happy to fight on both those hills, but I guess I would just kind of like wrap up by like, I mean, like the empathy piece is what kind of drives all this. And that gets you a good chunk of the way there. It's just thinking, how would I feel if I was shown in this way, you know, this icon of this but like an icon of a woman in a dress with a pink, baby pink color. Like, is that how we want to represent, you know?
Is that everybody?
Women? Yeah, right. Yeah. Is that everybody? Is that how we want to represent people?
Do we want to talk about the history of pink that goes with it? It was a man's color originally. You know,
okay. Yes. You know this book?
Yes.
Yes. So
the Secret Lives of Color. It's fabulous.
Fabulous book. And I can't believe you just mentioned it. I have my bookmark on the chapter on pink because she talks about how it used to be flipped. Prior to like post-World War II, it was flipped.
It's the artist in me, okay? That's the secret behind the scenes.
Yeah.
I am also an artist, not just a mathematician.
But that stuff is like these hidden stories, right? They're just fascinating.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Now check out the next one is the color green.
Okay. All right.
I don't know how far they go in. I don't remember how far they went into the book. I was flipping through it, but green
is everything.
Yep. Royalty. Yeah. But also now green is a trustworthy color for businesses mm-hmm. and brands.
Right.
So if you take it from like not just having purple for a lot of Europe as royalty, a lot of the immigrants, even into the 90s to 2000s, especially from Portugal, Italy, Spain, they would drive green cars when they came to America. Because in America, they were building their wealth,
right.
especially having an immigrant family. You were building your wealth. And that's some of the unspoken language.
Right. I mean, it's also interesting, like just the cultural differences in color.
Yes.
Right? Like in Western civilization, where like red is stop, bad, you know, negative, whereas in Eastern cultures, it's the exact opposite. I mean, I've always, you know, my work is almost entirely U.S. focused, U.S. domestic focused. And I've always, like, felt bad for people who work at, like, some international organization where you have to make, like, this chart has to work for your U.S.
Everybody.
Audience and your European audience and your Chinese audience. Like, that has got to be so difficult to think about. You know, your colors really matter and are just interpreted in very different ways. And that's just a huge, huge challenge. Not to mention, back to the equity piece on, like, accessibility, right? Like, accessibility is also an equity issue. And so the native is world, I would argue and have argued lots of places that the field is a little overly focused on color vision deficiency, like in
particular
red green. But there's lots of types of disabilities and impairments that impact people's ability to understand information or to use computers or to use
definitely
paper or whatever it is, right? I did I've been doing this project at work. It's a data physicalization project. So it's like it's making graphs with physical things. So it's like, here's a map of the United States in post-it notes, right? So each state is a post-it note. And here's a disc, little wooden disc, like put the disc on the state that you were born in, something like that. So we make these fun little graphs. And as part of some more research into that, I spoke to a bunch of folks who do museum installations. And just thinking about the variety of challenges you need to consider, right? How are kids, you know, you're going to build a table, right, in the Museum of Natural History. How are kids going to be able to see it? How is someone in a wheelchair going to be able to see it? Is the room going to be light or dark? Like, I mean, there's just so many variations to think about.
Definitely.
It's really just kind of a fascinating area.
Now, behind the scenes of what you do on a daily basis, you also have Policy Viz podcast.
Yeah.
Tell us about it, because I know that a lot of folks here, we do have a large audience. We do different things, more engineering side, but also a lot of these people are in policy. They're in government and engineering and also higher ed. So the stuff that we do is this also the things that we can learn from you.
Yeah. So thanks. Yeah. My show is really talking to folks in and around the data visualization field who are focusing on How do I communicate my data better? How do I communicate my data to have impact? So lots of authors come on the show. One of the guests I had at the end of my last season was Georgia Lupi, who's really well known for her sort of bespoke visualizations. She had this incredible story in the New York Times about long COVID that was kind of looked like paint brushes, like different yep. different swatches of paint. It was just beautiful work. Oftentimes, I'll try and get people on who can talk about tools, like specific electric clothes and how to build tools. I'm going to talk to someone from Invivo in the fall, right, which is the qualitative data yes. data tool. I've talked to people who use R from Posit, the Posit company, to talk about how to use R.
With doing data visualization and working with people in policy and communication, and I'll even throw in educators, science yeah. communicators, yeah. what is the biggest thing that you want people to take away from this podcast, from this episode, and also learning about more data in general?
Okay.
And also yeah, listening to your podcast.
Yeah, well, obviously.
That's obvious.
Yeah. Obvious, yeah. I think, and this is nice, because this is kind of where we started, right? So it's like full circle. I think the thing to start with is who is your audience? What do you want them to do? What are the insights you want them to find? What are the discoveries you want them to make? How is your work going to help them learn better, do their job better, whatever you want them to do? If you could just think really hard about your audience, and a lot of this is just an evolution. It's a journey. You put stuff out, you see what works, what doesn't work. You see what your audience needs, doesn't need, what they use, what they don't use. But I think if you start there, a lot of the other stuff sort of falls into place, and that's and a lot of this is also just learning and growing and trying and changing. I mean, I get asked a lot to teach like data viz, you know, 201, like a 201 class. And I'm like, yeah. The 201 class is just doing it. Like you just gotta get in there and do it. If I'm not gonna teach you a tool, how to code in this language or how to build a dashboard in this thing, if we're just talking about core principles of data viz, there is no 201. 201 is just doing it, man. You got to get out there and you got to try it. And some of it's going to work, some of it's not going to work. But I promise people that if they think really hard about who they're trying to reach, and even for your educators, right? I mean, all the educators who are listening to this, you know, who have taught at different grade levels, know that sixth graders, ninth graders, and 12th graders learn in very different ways, right? And so yep. they know that instinctively. And so we, you know, the rest of us have to learn that it is about knowing who your audience is. And the rest of it, I think, just kind of falls into place.
Wonderful. Thank you, John, so much for coming on this episode of Breaking Math.
Thanks, Autumn. That was a lot of fun.
It was a pleasure having you.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this. Even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at rss.com.